Welcome to Canary in a Cornfield, a podcast from the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, where we explore how the policies that shape our food and farming systems impact our health, our communities, and our future. As most of our listeners probably know, the Harkin Institute was founded upon the retirement of longtime public servant and Iowa legend Tom Harkin in order to continue doing high-quality work on the policy issues that were important to him. So I am really excited right now to be joined by the one and only Rachel Atchison, who I feel like a podcast can't do justice to, because to understand Rachel, you have to see her in action day to day and how absurdly productive she is. She's like a Tasmanian devil, except instead of leaving a wake of destruction in her path, it's a wake of awesomeness. So Rachel Atchison from Food Policy Pathways, thank you so much for taking time to join me.
Very excited to be here.
And Rachel just gave a talk to the Food Sustainability Advisory Committee of Des Moines. So thank you also for doing that. I really appreciate it. I think everyone was wowed by your knowledge.
It was a wonderful blast from the past, but it was a wonderful full circle moment because my father's from Des Moines. And so just having the ability to bring my own background of city government and how it works to a city that my father grew up in is really special.
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah, that's definitely what, before we start talking about food policy pathways, I wanted to talk about your time in city government, and your understanding of government in general is always blows my mind how deeply intertwined you are with a lot of different policy things going on. So maybe you could tell me first, you started out in nonprofit world, and then how did you initially get involved in politics?
Yeah, so I was in the nonprofit sector for about 5 years, and when you are on the outside looking in, you think, oh, why does the system work like it does? And can I disrupt and change the system? And you're throwing things from the outside. So I took a deep breath on that and decided, let me try and work from the inside and see how it goes. And I very fortuitously got a call from the New York City mayor's office and was asked to come in and interview. And I uprooted my life. I was at the time in Washington, D.C., and I remember I knew three people in New York City. I really had not been to New York much. I lived in Philly prior to that and Boston prior to that before growing up in D.C. So I always knew it's like big city, but I had never really been. I was always like considered too chaotic in my mind. And so I took that leap of faith to work in the New York City Mayor's Office in the Community Affairs Unit. And it was the first best leap of faith that I made.
Yeah. And that was the de Blasio administration, right?
The administration. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. And then you had the foresight. So didn't you work for the Brooklyn?
Yeah. So I left the de Blasio administration about a year and a half in after I feel like I had made as much progress in the administration as I could. And a friend introduced me to the then Brooklyn Borough President, Eric Adams. And I took my next big leap of faith and tried to think through, okay, what would a career going from the mayor's office to the Brooklyn Borough President's office look like? And if anyone knows city government, you usually don't try and go that direction. You usually try and go progress towards the mayor's office. But at the time, I was thinking, what is the likelihood that this person would be the next mayor? And I remember asking an operative in the mayor's office, and he said, Eric has a pretty good shot. But this was 4 years out, and we really had no idea. But fast forward 4 years, and I worked my ass off on the campaign alongside a lot of other people, and we won by 10,000 votes. So it was close, but we made it. And in that time, I was able to really get to know city government really well. I studied all of the agencies that touched food. I studied who controlled the different procurement budgets. I studied really who had power. And I then got to know, okay, that bureau in that department, that's where a lot of stuff happens. Okay, this team within that agency is where that happens, et cetera. And so it was really a very good learning exercise to be in an office where you have that ability.
Yeah. And you're someone who thinks quite a lot about how you can do the most good and how you can have the most impact. And that's pretty impressive that you were able to predict that far in advance.
I'm so lucky. So lucky. I think what I try and instill to our candidates when they're, we'll get into food policy pathways in a minute, but what I try to instill into our candidates is to achieve the goal, you have to be in the right place at the right time, but then repeat that 50 times. And eventually one of those times, it's going to work to your advantage. And so I instill that in my life, trying to be in the right place at the right time as many times as possible.
Okay. All right. More than just luck. But yeah, you definitely did put yourself in an amazing position. And that's what I wanted to talk about next, because under the next administration you served in the mayor's office, you did an incredible job making a lot of big changes that were influential in New York City. And then, of course, because of New York City's cultural and political relationship with the rest of the world, that has influence everywhere. So first of all, I mean, you must have connected right away with Eric Adams in terms of having a perspective on food and caring deeply about healthy diets. So how did that initially start? And then how did you come into your role in the office eventually?
So the person who introduced me to Eric was a doctor named Dr. Michael Greger. And he was giving a talk. He runs a website called nutritionfacts.org, and he teaches a lot about lifestyle medicine. And I was able to really connect with Eric because he had just gone through a real big health transition. He was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. My entire family in Iowa and in Kentucky have type 2 diabetes and heart disease. And so he learned after going to five doctors in New York, and none of those doctors saying, look at the food. He went to the Cleveland Clinic and saw Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn. And Dr. Esselstyn taught him about plant-based nutrition and was able to help Eric reverse his type 2 diabetes. And one of the reasons that I got into healthy diets is I grew up with eczema. I had really bad eczema on my arms and legs, so bad that sometimes I'd wake up when I was a kid with my arms and legs bleeding because I had scratched the skin raw. And none of the dermatologists that I went to when I was a kid ever said, let's look at what you eat. And turns out that I stopped eating dairy and my eczema cleared up overnight. So I had always known that food could be this powerful tool and could be this powerful mechanism if we knew about it and if we could utilize it. And so when Eric went through his journey, we met shortly after that, and I was amazed that he couldn't find that support in New York City, the largest city in the country. He couldn't understand from doctors there that food held that power. And when he found that out from the Cleveland Clinic, he actually got his eyesight back in his left eye. He had no more tingling in his fingers and toes. And again, his A1C level went to normal. And I gravitated towards someone who prioritized looking at what their food could do to them. And Eric had lofty goals with food. He said, why are we feeding our students this type of food? He was, in essence, he was very maha before maha existed, because he was very intrigued. Like, why would we use taxpayer dollars to pay for diet-related chronic diseases? And so it was an honor to join his team and think through the agencies that serve food in New York City and think through, could those agencies serve healthier food and happen to be more environmentally friendly food?
Yeah. Since I just heard you talk, you were saying earlier that the mayor's office in New York has quite a lot of power when it comes to procurement.
Yeah. So the mayor's office in New York City has a ton of mayoral control. So a lot of jurisdictions don't have control over what they buy for food. But in New York, we control what is served in schools, in hospitals, in jails, and older adult centers. So there's a lot of institutional food service, and each are run differently. Some are self-operated, some are contracted out. But the Mayor's Office of Food Policy is really the coordinating body for all of those entities and guides the decisions of what the mayor believes around this. And the mayor had some strong beliefs on food. And so we served a lot more healthy food, a lot more environmentally friendly food in that time.
Can you talk a little bit more about some of those programs that you were able to put in place?
So before I joined, the movement in New York City was already, the food policy movement and the ecosystem was already doing a lot. They were already fighting for universal free lunch. They were already on the path of fighting for good food purchasing. And so that's a values-based procurement program around the country. And so when we joined, we looked at each of the agencies that serve food, and we thought, you know, are there innovative programs we could bring to them? So for instance, in the jail system, we brought a culinary training program to the food service workers and really redesigned their menus. In the hospital system, we looked at what the default was. And when we came in, about 1% of people opted for the plant-based entree, and about 99% opted for the main chef special. We looked at that chef special and said, it's meat every day. Could we make it plant-based as the default, with people having the ability to choose a meat option? And so we decided to shift that default, and now 50% of people stick with the plant-based option, stick with that chef special, and 50% opt for the meat-based entree. So we're sidestepping any sort of culture war, but we are able to nudge people in the right direction. So we've now, in the hospital system, served a couple million plant-based meals that previously were not. And thankfully, there were some wonderful partners. Greener by Default did a great job of being the technical assistance partner on the ground. And because of that, we were able to save 59 cents per plant-based meal, because turns out chickpeas are cheaper than chicken. We were able to reduce carbon emissions by 36% in the first year of implementation. So it was a wonderful program. So we did things like that, and we looked at our hospital, our school meals, and found that we could actually partner with a local group called Wellness in the Schools and the Coalition for Healthy School Food, and actually bring culinary training into the school cafeterias and change the menus and make them more scratch cooking, more plant powered, et cetera.
That's really amazing. And so you mentioned the greenhouse gas emissions. Was it primarily coming from the health perspective, or was the environmental side of diets always part of the thinking?
I feel like this is the coolest part about working in food policy, is that you just get these win-wins across the board. And the first motivation was the health, but being able to reach climate commitment goals because this healthier food is actually better for the climate as well is just such a cherry on top moment.
And was the emissions from the food, was that always part of how New York City thought about climate change, or was that something that required a shift in thinking? Because I think that's maybe not the first thing that comes to people's mind, is by changing people's diets, you can actually have an impact on emissions.
Yeah, so we signed up for the Cool Food Pledge as a city, which is reducing carbon emissions by 25% by 2030. A international movement that the World Resources Institute leads. We signed up for a couple of these pledges that would get us to think actively about carbon emissions and our food system, which is terrific, because it's one of the nudges I think government needs to actively embrace change.
And so from the outside, it seemed like you guys were pretty bold about putting these initiatives in place. Was it something where it was like, let's just see what we can do and do it? Or were you still worried about, okay, if we go this far, then people might get really upset?
Solid question. We did not do anything that really jeopardized any sort of politics or anything. We did things that we knew were scientifically backed. And we did things that, for instance, with the hospital default program, like, if he wanted me to, could have it. It wasn't that line in the sand, but it was bold. And in fact, I'm still waiting for more cities to follow suit, because I think it is the right thing to do. And so it definitely took some political will to make it happen. But also, when you're looking at the data, plant-forward policies is the direction that we as a country, as a world, should be going. And a lot of the experts on the inside know that. But I think being able to be given the permission to do the thing that they know they should be doing was the permission structure we were able to grant.
And hopefully seeing that New York can do it and there weren't people with pitchforks out in the street, 99% approval in the hospital, 98%. Right? 98%. Yeah.
So folks love the meal. We had Chef Phil with Sodexo. He just took 6 months to design these delicious menu options. And it really helps when you have someone from the culinary world who knows hospital food and says, let's do better. and really taken run with that. So you did great. And the food is delicious. I encourage everyone in the world of food policy to taste the food that you are serving, whether it's in schools, hospitals, or jails, et cetera, because it's just so important to really taste the product. And I can tell you with certainty, the product is fantastic in New York City health and hospitals.
You also mentioned earlier that you went to Rikers in terms of tasting the food. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I am a firm believer that we all need to taste the food. And I went to Rikers several times and tasted the food and was not thrilled with the direction it was going. And that was the impetus for applying for a grant from the Carbon Neutral Cities Alliance to bring a culinary training that reduced carbon emissions into the jail system. Very proud of that work as well.
Yeah, very neat. Okay, one last question before I get to food policy pathways, which I think ties in a little bit. So while you were in New York, were you approached by other cities, other groups that were like, how do we do this where we're at?
Yeah, so several cities visited, whether it was our hospital system or our school system, for tours. It was actually funny, though, because a lot of European countries would send people to visit. And so it was less U.S. cities than European cities, but definitely word got out. I think there was a little bit less cultural backlash towards having a more plant-forward approach to food policy in Europe in some ways, since there was European cities. But yeah, we had people visit and see that none of this is rocket science, that if you serve delicious food, you can win over a policy agenda item such as environmentally friendly food or healthier food.
We could talk about all of your amazing achievements in New York for a long time, but it's late and you're very gracious. How did you decide to shift gears and form food policy pathways?
I was inside government for 8 years and I was looking for other staffers around the country who might want to execute some of the policies that we executed in New York. And I couldn't find them. There were small pockets. There were some people who worked with C40, for instance, or some people who worked with the Center for Good Food Purchasing, but they weren't that organized of a group. And so that meant that expanding policies that were successful for us in New York to other cities was more difficult than I expected because there wasn't that sort of listserv where all city employees who work on food policy is, et cetera. And so I was looking around and I would have about one person a week come to me and say, hey, I might not do what you do elsewhere. And so I'd always late on a Friday afternoon after work talk with these people. And as time went on, I was like, oh, I really like coaching these people to go into government. And so I just took that as a sign and said, you know what, instead of complaining that no one else is wanting to advance this food policy agenda inside government, why not just create the pipeline that funnels people who understand environmental resilience and healthy nutrition and animal welfare? Why don't we funnel these people into government roles around the country? And so I launched Food Policy Pathways about a year and a half ago, and I am so proud. We have helped place 20 people last year into government roles, and we're on track to place 30 people this year. And these are everything from an internship to a fellowship to full-time roles in city, state, and federal government. And I think that there are a lot of wonderful folks who want to make the world a better place, but the nonprofit sector is really appealing, or maybe private sector is really appealing. A lot of times people don't think that government will be for them. And I think that we need to be actively utilizing all the tools in the toolbox to make the world a better place. And turns out government is a major player in food and agriculture in this country. And so I decided to start the pipeline.
How much of a learning curve was it to figure out how government worked at many different places, because I was so impressed that you came to Des Moines, Iowa, which is totally different. And yet you gave really wonderful, concrete suggestions that just seemed on point and like very relevant for our situation, even though so many differences with New York City. So how hard was it to get to where you're at in terms of understanding many different places?
Turns out that governments around the country are not that different. Turns out that you have to build political allies and you have to build political will for the policy goals that you have. And departments and agencies, they each have their own jurisdiction and they each have their own bureaus that advance different priorities. And that's the same everywhere. New York is huge. So I have a lot of experience working with a lot of different personalities in the city. But for the most part, government workers want to make the world a better place, but there's a ton of bureaucracy that stands in the way. And so you have to be creative. And I think that creativity is not rocket science. It's building up the political will, building up the infrastructure, making sure that you're shooting for sometimes budget neutral items or building that political will to get the budget that you want. I just think that it is interesting when I've spoken to government workers all around the country, and we all say the same thing, that there's the same roadblocks, the same hurdles. But actually, if you have enough folks on the inside who are rowing in the same direction as you, you can achieve the policy goals that you set your eyes on.
Interesting. So how do you go about finding the different government positions that you place people in?
Yeah. So our candidates, our program participants, are actually doing that themselves. We don't find the roles that they're applying for them. There are some roles that are very competitive. So for instance, the House Agriculture Committee or the Senate Agriculture Committee or the House Natural Resources or Senate Natural Resources. There are definitely some places that folks are, like, we've got a lot of candidates. We just, this week I did prep for 4 candidates having interviews with the House Agriculture Committee. We've definitely got some places that we're in more often. But for the most part, food is still in its early stage of being a part of a political movement. Politics didn't intersect with food for years outside of USDA, FDA. And so there are very few offices of food policy explicitly, which means that we're really directing our candidates to look at the departments of health or the departments of environmental protection and looking at those entities and seeing who oversees food within these agencies. For instance, in New York City, the Bureau of Chronic Disease Prevention within the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, that is where a lot of the food policy decisions get made for the city. Or within the Mayor's Office of Climate and Environmental Justice, there's a small team that work on carbon emissions, and that is the team that you want to work on if you want to touch food. And so there are different levers, and they're the same in a lot of different cities and states. And so if you are wanting to advance more on the lifestyle medicine front, looking at state departments of health or city departments of health is a really good starting point. So there's some sameness across the board.
And do you have any thoughts on why food was non-political for a while and then that shifted?
I think we're still at the very beginning of the shift. I think that our food system is incredibly complicated, and a lot of politicians see it as being so personal. So we haven't systemically thought, okay, yes, it is personal what someone chooses at home, but it's actually incredibly public when you're talking about school food or hospital food, et cetera. And then when you're talking about our healthcare crisis, where we're all paying taxes for these very large healthcare bills that are largely type 2 diabetes or heart disease or obesity related, you actually zoom out further and you're like, oh, wait, our food system is incredibly public. And what we decide on a federal level, we decide on a state level, really impacts how much healthcare taxes we're all paying. And so it just gets a little bit more obvious. So if we really need to be looking at this from a public standpoint.
Yeah, I've always found it bizarre because food is such a central part of everyone's life. And yet there's so many dimensions of it that most people don't think of. I also wanted to ask, how much of you being good at your job is the fact that you're incredibly networked? You're just someone who seems really connected. You've helped me many times. Like, if I ever, do you know someone who does this thing in the food system? And you always have some great ideas. So is that why Food Policy Pathways is as successful, is because you have this network of people all around the country and building it even more by putting people in positions?
Yeah, we try and teach that love of networking to our candidates. And I like to say to folks that networking, the beautiful part about it, because obviously it has different connotations depending on who's listening to this, but the beautiful part about networking is if you approach it as, how can I help them, it becomes this thing where I now believe in karma, where I'm like, I've helped a lot of people. And turns out that a lot of people want to help me. And that positive feedback loop is just so beautiful. And so we try and instill that with our candidates. We teach them about pointers when attending events and how to stay connected with any of the people we introduce them to. One of the mechanisms that Food Policy Pathways does for our candidates is we introduce them to mentors. And these mentors are either in government or have been in government. And once you're inside government, you get to know how the system works. And so our mentors are able to impart some wisdom on, oh, you're framing yourself as this. If you pivoted and framed yourself as this, you would probably reach that interview. I would say Food Policy Pathways success is not necessarily my network that has been successful, though it has definitely helped a few of our candidates, but instead it's the scalability of, can we teach the broad usefulness of building a network to advance better food policy? And turns out we definitely can.
So who is the ideal candidate of someone who would want to connect with Food Policy Pathways, or if you know someone else that might be good to put in touch with Food Policy Pathways?
Yeah, we'd love folks listening to this to think through your network and think, is there one or two people that I can text and say, hey, have you heard about this group, Food Policy Pathways? So we have really a broad range of folks who work for us as candidates. And that is, we're really looking for hustlers. That is the number one thing I am looking for. I'm looking for someone who wants to work their butt off to advance a better food system. And so it's not any specific degree. There are a wide range of degrees that come to us. Some folks are out of law school. Some folks have a master's in environmental science. Some folks have PhDs, but I would say our sort of average candidate is someone who has an undergrad degree in something like public policy or health or nutrition. MPHs are pretty common with us, or someone who's very interested in the environment. So it is really a range, and there isn't one degree that I'd say you're not going to fit in government. Government, in my 8 years working in government, I think I was asked what my degree was a whopping 5 times. It really doesn't come up a ton if you can accomplish the priorities of your office and priorities of your team. And I'd say if you are someone who wants to change our food system in a better direction, in a healthier, more resilient direction, we are looking for you.
And anything else people should be doing to follow what Food Policy Pathways is up to?
We've got a LinkedIn. Feel free to follow that LinkedIn. And for anyone here who knows someone who works in government changing the food system, we'd love to have them sign up as a mentor as well.
And what if you're a government agency and you're like, gosh, I really wish we had a wonderful candidate for this position. Can they also reach out to you?
Absolutely. So we actually have a lot of relationships with government offices and elected officials around the country who are on ag committees, for instance, and are looking for summer interns. And they turn to us and say, hey, can you recommend a few candidates? And so I'll send them a batch of resumes, and usually works out well. Definitely any agency who's looking at making the food system better. We've got a talented pool of folks who, as I mentioned, usually hustle pretty hard and definitely reach out to us.
And you're the coach who runs sprints with your players because you're always hustling.
It's true. I do like to model by example. And when you said coach, it's funny because I'm driving my race team in a couple of weeks. So I'm like, yes, I am a coach too.
Thank you so much for being gracious to your time and joining me, and wonderful to talk to you as always.
This was so fun. Thanks so much.
That's it for this week's episode of Canary in a Cornfield. Just a reminder, you can find the Harkin Institute on social media, which includes X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and find our webpage at harkininstitute@drake.edu. And this podcast is also hosted by Substack Canary in a Cornfield, which will include some additional links and resources that go beyond just what's in the episode. So thank you all for tuning in, and I will be talking with you soon.